Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcast, Podcast 438. It is Sunday night in podcast time, and I'm going to get you set up by resetting for the new week, the final week, which will be, of course, a short week because of Thanksgiving, smack dab in the middle of the last, I guess it's the second to last week of November 2015. So in this podcast, it's time to address a couple of big stories, the big story, in fact, and to kind of take a moment to reset. So we're going to talk about the attacks in Paris a little bit here in podcast 438. Well, I've been feeling a little under the weather the last few days and got ahead of the production schedule a little bit so I could take a little bit of time off, but I continued to practice yoga. And there's a whole difference of opinion in the yoga community about whether you should practice when you're feeling under the weather or below the optimal physical. I felt kind of like I had the flu or a cold, but I continued to practice. And one of the reasons is Hydrus. And different yoga teachers have different ideas about that. I'm part of the school that says that if you're sick, unless you really are, you have the flu and you're super contagious or you can't move, the best thing you can do is probably go to yoga and just continue to practice. And one of my teachers was saying, the problem with you athletic types is that you just won't quit. And that's kind of the deal. I mean, I don't quit. And I have practiced all through my sort of under the weather, below the line kind of illness the last few days because I love doing yoga. I love what it does for me. And I practice every day without fail, sometimes twice a day, although I wasn't doing that this week. It isn't for the faint of heart, as I have said many, many times. You're in crowded rooms of over 100 degrees with high humidity and you sweat a lot. And you accept soreness and pain that degrades your practice and causes injuries, but I don't have to do that anymore. And it's one of the reasons I was able to practice while feeling slightly under the weather because I've discovered something that really has amazed me. And I'm telling everybody about it, and it's transformed my yoga practice. And I know regardless of what you do, whether you cross-country ski or you have tennis elbow or you lift weights, whether you do CrossFit, bike, soul cycle, workout with weights, anything like that can be physically demanding, anything, any kind of work that's physically demanding, you need to know about something called Hydrus. Hydrus is a high-performance beverage that uses exclusive nanosonde technology to deliver critical electrolytes with unrivaled speed and effectiveness without the sugar that you have in traditional sports drinks. Now, that's the official language of Hydrus. Now, I can tell you from experience, Hydrus has transformed my yoga practice. First of all, I just told you that I was able to practice even though I was ill and I wasn't sore because of Hydrus. I practice every day and I do all kinds of yoga. With Hydrus before, during, and after, the bottom line is my practice is stronger, it's more fulfilling. I don't have to deal with pain or soreness, particularly on the recovery side. And I really can't believe how much stronger my practice is getting with Hydrus. It gives me the edge I'm looking for, and it can do the same for you no matter what you do. So if you are a coach, if you have kids in high school sports or college sports, believe me, it'll make a huge difference in their workouts and what they're able to do. And if you think just drinking water does the same thing, you know, I always consumed a lot of water. I still drink a lot of water, but adding Hydrus to it makes a huge difference. Hydrus, increased work capacity, no bloating, reduces fatigue and cramping, as I said, improves recovery. It uses no sugar and there's no calories, and it's been tested with world class athletes. Hydrus before, during, and after exercise. Join the performance hydration revolution. It's incredible. Check it out at hydrusperformance.com. That's hydrusperformance.com, and it's Hydrus, or you can click on the banner at the top of the bobdavispodcast.com. And thanks you guys for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. So we're starting to get that Thanksgiving weather. It's starting to feel like winter. I got a bunch of calls this week from people that said, hey, how are you dealing with all the snow? And of course, we didn't get any snow in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I mean, there were fits and starts, sleet sort of, and maybe some snow in different places at different times last week. But as far as the 20 inches that Janesville, Wisconsin got, we got none of that. So we are still brown in the upper tier above Chicago, so to speak, the upper Midwest. And winter hasn't started, but, you know, we'll probably get there by Thanksgiving. But aside from feeling under the weather, I also felt, because of the Paris attacks, in the aftermath of the Paris attacks all this week, And I have struggled with this because there's a lot that I want to say. But at the same time, I went back and listened to podcast 437, and there's still really a lot of salient stuff said in that podcast, because what I predicted was going to happen is exactly what is happening. And that is, everybody and his uncle is going out and popping off and acting like some kind of an expert about terror or how to handle it or what should be done, including all of the political candidates. And it's obscuring it's obscuring any real thought on how to solve this problem that anyone would engage in. So we're going to talk about that a little bit in this podcast as I sit here by the fire and sip my coffee. So yeah, I was feeling under the weather, and I started to do this podcast a couple of different times, and I couldn't. My thoughts were completely disjointed, and I'm not using any notes. And again, sometimes I really don't like talking about foreign policy types of issues without having notes or writing out an outline to know where I want to go, because it's hard to get it all in a 30-minute podcast. But I've decided what I'm going to do. I wrote up a bunch of notes, and I started to do a podcast. Actually, two different days this week, I sat down to do a podcast. The first couple of times, I really couldn't even think. I couldn't, even with notes, my mind wasn't working right, and I think it was due to this. I've just been sleeping a lot thing, and it's muscle aches and pains, and been sleeping a lot, and I'm feeling a little bit better now, so there's that. But the other thing is, it's the complexity of the issue and trying to get a handle on what it is exactly that I am feeling and thinking. And I alternate between being mad at leaders and being mad at the way the media covers this. And one of the stories I wanted to tell is that I have a friend who has a really irrational fear of mice. And she has a mouse infestation in her apartment. And, you know, they came and they put up a bunch of traps, and the mice are being, you know, killed right and left. And then I'm the body disposal guy. I have to go in and, as she says, dispose of the bodies and get them out of there, because she doesn't want to see it. And I was over there. I'm trying to remember what day it was. I think it was like Thursday or Friday. I was over there and to remove some of the bodies. And you know, she had CNN on, and she was talking about how she's obsessed with the Paris attacks. And what I do in the normal course of a day in terms of show prep, in terms of reading the news, I have taught myself to become relatively well informed on the contours of news of the day in about 10 minutes. And that starts, you know, when I wake up. I'm not exactly a morning person, but I'd gotten up fairly early that day and done my due diligence, so I knew what the newest developments in the Paris case were, and go over to her house and was shocked because it was dark. It was like 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, and I was shocked because here we are watching CNN, and for a full hour, virtually nothing new was reported. Now, if you think of news as a recitation of a series of facts which describe an event that has occurred in the present time frame. News, in other words, here are the five W's, the who, what, where, why, and when of a particular event. It is shocking to me that in 12 hours of coverage, continuous wall-to-wall coverage, and certainly that wasn't the only 12 hours of the continuous wall-to-wall coverage. Remember, it happened a week earlier, and it had been wall-to-wall coverage all week on Fox and MSNBC and the networks and talk radio and everything else, with people doing exactly what I said they would do, screaming and shouting, having arguments on the screens, with the crawl across the bottom about what Ben Carson said and what Donald Trump said and what Hillary Clinton said, and this incredible nervous system reaction, which does nothing but get people more and more emotional. So it provokes television's job, its primary – actually, I shouldn't say it's its job, but television's primary effect is to raise an emotional reaction on the part of the listener. It has a tendency to magnify an emotional reaction. And so people all over the world are watching this 24-hour-a-day coverage with no new real facts and no real movement of the story forward in terms of what needs to be done or what the right strategy is going to be. Lots of rhetoric and political stuff and no real substance. And you wonder why people are exhausted or why people are emotionally spent and really angry and frustrated and feel powerless because of this going on 24 hours a day. And I don't watch television. So whenever I encounter that kind of coverage, and because I'm able to sit down in 10 minutes and just give myself, you know, a pretty good background in terms of the contours of the news, then I'll print it up and read it later and get more into depth. But I was just shocked at the lack of information and the amount of emotional intensity coming out of this coverage for a week. And all the things that were said, this is exactly what I said people should avoid after the attack in Paris on Friday. In fact, I would go so far as to suggest to people that when something like this happens, aside from watching the first couple of hours of coverage, I would suggest that you just simply turn it off and just go online and read news stories when you want to know what's going on by going to some sort of news aggregator and probably not Drudge, going to AP Breaking News or Twitter Breaking News or some aggregator that, Real Clear Politics or Real Clear World that tells you, gives you a series of articles that you can read instead of sitting there and watching television. And so then what I did was I came home after that and I thought, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a podcast and I'm going to lay out the history of ISIS because I think that's really important. And, you know, I did it. I did all my research on the history of ISIS and where it's coming from and everything else. And I wrote it all out and I was going to do it as a podcast. And I left it for a day and came back 24 hours later and I just could not piece it together. So that's why I haven't done a podcast. Because really, you don't need to hear the history of ISIS from me. If you really want to know the history of ISIS, all you have to do is type in history of ISIL or ISIS and you'll get the phone book. And you can go to Wikipedia or you can go to militarytimes.com or you can go to a bunch of different sites and you will find out that ISIS as a group has developed over a period of the last 3, 4, 5 years. Part of the origin of ISIS as a group is because of the effort by the Shiite government of Iraq in the wake of the U.S., you know, propping up of the government of Iraq. They started to suppress what they considered to be Sunni terrorism in Western Iraq, and in the process, they created the enmity on the part of the Sunnis in Iraq, in Western Iraq, which is a tribal Sunni region, against the Shiite government in Baghdad, and the rest is history. Later then, this group started fighting in Syria when the Syrian protests provoked sort of inter-Sunni struggles and then a civil war, and the existing rebel groups were exhausted, and three Islamic groups got together. Al-Nusra and another, I think it was Al-Qaeda Syria, and then this sort of ragtag Al-Qaeda Iraq Sunni group got together and under the leadership or the aegis of 100 or so former Saddam Ba'athist commanders in the military got together and became the Islamic State and then began fighting Assad in Syria. Now, it's important also to point out that this does not mean that all the Sunnis in Western Iraq are against the majority Shia government in Baghdad. The first targets of ISIL or ISIS were the Muslims who would prefer to have some sort of pluralistic government, which in their case is probably more along the lines of tribal councils, or at least would prefer to have a more secular or a secular type of government, if that explanation will suffice. So the first targets of this group were the so-called, I hate to call them moderate because that doesn't really describe them, but the the Sunnis who were interested in some kind of pluralistic government in Iraq. And it's really important to point that out because it makes it sound like the Shia. I mean, one of the common misnomers is that the Shia suppressed the Sunnis. My understanding is what they were doing was suppressing or trying to suppress the remnants of the Ba'athist regime that preceded, obviously, the current, that was Saddam's government, the Ba'athists, and these Al-Qaeda Iraq elements. Some of these chieftains were the people that fought with us during the Awakening Movement, during the Surge, to try to tamp down Al-Qaeda Iraq. So it's probably silly for me to try to explain this, you know, with any degree of accuracy in terms of the types of group. But quite honestly, this is probably more than you've learned in 5, 6, 7 hours of watching Fox News or CNN because everyone's fighting and arguing. They're not talking about the existing situation. So it's really important to point out that this is a group controlled by former Saddam Army officers and leadership, and they give their orders through emirs. And my understanding is that the people in Syria who are part of the Syrian version or the group in Syria fighting on behalf of ISIS are given their orders by Syrian emirs who are shadowed by masked commanders from Iraq. And the other thing to point out is that the West has generally underestimated the organization and the scope and the capabilities and the power of this group called ISIS or ISIL. There's a German reporter, I think his name is Jürgen Todenhofer or something like that. He embedded with them for a period of months and said that we are vastly underestimating the passion with which they're fighting, the number of recruits that they're adding, and their leadership capabilities. It's really important to point out that this group is using as an ideology a desire to bring on the apocalypse, because in the apocalypse, the true descendant of Muhammad will take over, and their objective is a stated objective in all of their media and everywhere else. Their stated objective is to take over the world and kill all of the infidels and apostates, which is us. So this is not something that is a regional group. This is not something that is specifically, you know, oh, they're just trying to, you know, get control of a part of Western Iraq and protect the Sunnis, which is, until I actually started reading some history of the group, is what I thought. It's a potential existential threat because their objective is to kill anyone who essentially disagrees with them on any level. And so unless you convert and become part of their movement, then you are to be killed regardless of where you come from or who you are or what you believe. Now, in a second here, I'm going to talk about history, because if you just listen to that history of ISIS, that's kind of an out-of-context history of this group, this movement, whatever you want to call it, the Islamic State. And before we can figure out a strategy to deal with them, everybody in this country has to understand what it is and why these things happen. And so history is a big part of it. And you know I'm going to talk about history demonstrating that one of the paths to personal wealth is through property ownership, because this has been a standard thing throughout history. And today, a lot of people are continuing to rent while waiting to purchase their first home or to move up to their next home. But in the last 5 years or so, the thing you need to know about the real estate market is that there's been a lot of foreclosures, there's been a lot of houses sitting empty for a long time, and then you have these houses that have been renovated by these fly-by-night house flippers. And you got to have somebody who knows the market to negotiate that risk, and it's real risk. The other thing is interest rates have been at near historically low levels for many years. There is pressure on the Fed to increase rates. There is talk that they may yet do it in December. So this is the time to take advantage of low interest rates if you're in the market for real estate or someone you love is considering buying their first home. I want to introduce prideofhomes.com to listeners and subscribers to the Bob Davis podcast. I've been doing this for a while. Prideofhomes.com is a husband-wife real estate team and real estate investors with expertise to share with you. I should say that they are a licensed husband and wife real estate team. Reach out to Eric and Aram Lucero with Luke Team Real Estate and prideofhomes.com in two ways. You can click on the banner at the top of the bobdavispodcast.com, go to prideofhomes.com, or just call them. If you're looking for a house in the North and Northwest Metro, Maple Grove, Plymouth, Rogers, Dayton, Champlin, Albertville, St. Michael, Elk River, or the North Metro Corridor. For real estate expertise, Eric and Aram Lucero Sarah with Luke Team Real Estate. Visit their website today at prideofhomes.com. Luke Team is awesome on customer service. I've actually had people tell me on Facebook and through email at the Bob Davis Podcast that those guys are great. 763-433-9100. 763-433-9100. And very quickly, thanks to the digital sponsor of the BobDavisPodcast.com. We have a lot of pilots listening to the Bob Davis Podcast. If you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, let me suggest Alpha Systems' revolutionary angle of attack indicator. The bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. It's FAA approved. They are the leader in this field. Get them into your avionics package because we want you to come home. Click on the Alpha Systems banners for more information about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at the Bob Davis Podcast. So there was an article in Vox this week which sets forth the idea that the United States is responsible for terror because we supported the freedom fighters in Afghanistan in the 80s. And there's a picture of Reagan sitting with the Afghan freedom fighters, or Afghani, or however you say what an Afghan is, Afghanistan citizen or whatever, sitting in the White House with the president. And a picture of a newspaper article that had a picture of bin Laden in sunnier days in Afghanistan, listing him as a freedom fighter fighting for the United States, which is true. We did enlist the help of the freedom fighters, the Mujahideen, the jihadists in Afghanistan. But I think it's quite a stretch to say that the United States is responsible for all the terrorism. We certainly are not the father of jihad. That's been around for a long time. And terror has been part of the playbook for, disenfranchised or less powerful elements of all sorts of countries, Vietnam. I could go through the whole long list, Asia and the Middle East and so forth for a long, long time. So no, we didn't start terrorism. But it brings up an interesting point, because what happened is that, and in particular as it pertains to the Middle East, these things have happened because of U.S. meddling in various countries for various reasons, whether it's a lot of people argue it started in World War I. I think it's fair to say that it really started with decolonialization after World War II, when the colonial powers of Europe simply could not afford to maintain their quote-unquote possessions in Africa and in the Middle East. And the Brits pulled out of the Middle East, and then that became the responsibility of the United States. With the arrival of the Soviets as a counterweight to the United States, and with the Cold War, then our policies were really adjusted to creating a coalition of states to oppose the coalition of states that were cobbled together by the Soviets in an effort to expand Soviet influence into the Middle East. So this is where the United States got involved in overthrowing Mossadegh in Iran, and this is where the United States got involved with overthrowing leaders and government regimes all over the world through the auspices of first the OSS and then the CIA and covert action. Eisenhower's chosen, his favorite method was to use covert action as opposed to overt action, because he did not believe that we should use large formations of U.S. troops. Almost everything that's happened in Latin America and in Asia and in the Middle East is a result of this sort of bipolar arrangement during the 40s, 50s, and 60s and 70s until the fall of the Berlin Wall in the late 80s, early 90s. So we're still trying to figure out a new foreign policy and how it's to be based, and whether we go back to a more traditional realist type of policy or whether we continue with the liberal world order, which simply states that free trade and democracy should be furthered across the world, and that intervention in states where things are unstable by the West is something that well serves the people of those places as well as the United States and the West in general. And that's really what's going on. And if any of this is to be solved, if there is to be a response to ISIL or ISIS, you have to take into account the fact that the West has been arming and meddling and playing around in that region for a long time in an effort to maintain control. example, we have alliances with Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabists who really control Saudi Arabia have the same philosophy as ISIS. I mean, Salafism, which is the ISIS philosophy, is a subset of Wahhabism, or influenced by Wahhabism, which is what controls the Saudi government, because the Wahhabists have an agreement with the royal family to be the state religion as long as the royal family is able to rule in Saudi Arabia. So here we are lauding our ally Saudi Arabia all the time, but they have the same philosophy as the Islamic State. So when you hear people like Jeb Bush, you know, and I'm just completely mystified by this, saying that we need to send, you know, overwhelming force into the Middle East, didn't we just try that? And then you see these poll numbers that say 60% of the American people think that we're at war with Islam and everything else. This is a result of all this ridiculous media coverage and all of this ridiculous polling, trolling for polling that goes on in the media that actually decides who gets into the debates, right? So it's really, really important that people understand that in order to address this problem, you are not going to address it in a 30-minute podcast. You are not going to address it in 10 minutes of vacuous talk radio. You are not going to address it in hours and hours and hours of really poor quality, low information television, which is designed to upset you and get you angry. Probably the most reasonable thing that we could do is suspend the Syrian refugee program until we can actually determine, and by we, I mean Congress, actually determine how Syrian refugees are vetted. But in any case, we should not be allowing them into this country. And I've found many Democrats who actually agree with that, as well as Republicans. But people should be aware that this is dangerous, because I'm hearing a lot of the same crap that I heard prior to Iraq, which convinced me and a lot of other people that we should invade Iraq. And it turned out to be, you know, the precursor for what we're dealing with now. I mean, you could argue that the fact that the United States invaded Iraq, broke the thing, and then left, basically, some say precipitously. You can agree with Obama or disagree with Obama, but most everybody in this country wanted to see troops withdrawn from Iraq almost immediately, and they want to see troops withdrawn from Afghanistan either, and they don't give a damn what happens to those people. And now, all of a sudden, we're being exhorted by the same people, you know, Bush and Rubio and McCain and Lindsey Graham, to send troops right back in there to do what? And they don't tell you we're going to defeat ISIS. Well, more than likely, you're going to get caught up in a struggle which has nothing to do with you. And now everybody's involved, the Russians and so forth, which really is what they want. And I hate to say that the president is right, but what he's saying, I think what he's actually saying is, I don't want to be involved in any way, shape, or form in another conflict. Because here's the thing, we're not going to be sending troops to Iraq under President Obama, because if President Obama sends troops back into Iraq to any sizable degree, that is going to be, it'll scuttle his presidency, because that was the whole basis of his being elected president, and it was the whole basis of his presidency. I will talk to the Iranians, I will get the troops out of there, I will bring peace, and it hasn't worked. So we need a new foreign policy. The question is what? And people are going to have, and when I say foreign policy, I'm not talking about a military strategy. That's a different thing entirely. The military strategy is subservient to an overall foreign policy. And as I said in podcast 437, foreign policy doesn't come out of a can. In other words, it doesn't come out of a meme or an exchange on Facebook or 100 characters on Twitter. It's something that we really have to think about. And it goes back to things like the Peace of Westphalia. You should look it up if you don't know about it. It goes back to treaties signed and adhered to since World War II, since World War I. It goes back to our perception in the modern world of our role as quote-unquote senior nations, at least in the post-World War II realm, in terms of protecting the peace and freedom of our own shores as well as our allies and the rest of the world. And this is, you know, this is our perception of how we view the world versus their perception of how they view the world. And this has the potential to become a very, very large conflict. So solving it is going to require some new thinking. And I'll tell you, the only place that I'm seeing any real new thinking about foreign policy is Rand Paul, who is saying, how is it conservative to break the budget by sending 250,000 troops to Iraq for what? since we've been arming these rebels, which was a huge mistake because now ISIS has our weapons. We don't even know what they have. And we've been arming rebels, and the money and the arming has been a failure, and those people have all joined with ISIS. So that doesn't work very well. But overall, I don't see any time being devoted by political candidates or by any of the people in the media to saying, what is the U.S. foreign policy? I don't think anybody in Washington could tell you what Obama's foreign policy is. They claim it's a realist liberal foreign policy. Some claim it's a constructivist foreign policy, which is a subset of those two foreign policy regimes, which are schools of thought. They're not liberal or conservative. One, real politics is usually associated with conservatives. Liberal is usually associated with Democrats. But we have certainly had people who have practiced liberal foreign policy who happen to be Republicans. So that doesn't hold. And constructivist is sort of a combination and sort of a new idea that has come from those three. But, you know, all three of them tend to be in some way, shape, or form interventionists. So as voters, people have to start thinking about this. I mean, my biggest complaint with what is going on is that the voters, not the leaders, not people like Tom Emmer who want to declare war on ISIS, or Jeb Bush that want to send troops to Iraq again, but the voters are sadly misinformed on something called foreign policy. I've done a lot of podcasts about it, but the best thing to do is to start reading foreign policy. Go to foreign policy, go to diplomacy, start reading up, go to realclearworld.com and start reading articles about foreign policy. Don't go to Russia Times and, InfoWars and conspiracy sites, but start to get a grounding in what foreign policy is. Some of you who have worked in, are military veterans, and some people who have worked across and been across and traveled understand this stuff inherently. But for the larger public, we're walking right back in to another trial by fire with unpredictable results. Is that what you want? Because you're about to get it. By the way, it's a realist foreign policy, not real politique. That's a different thing. And a liberal foreign policy, which, again, they don't have anything to do with right or left politically, although Republicans in the past have tended to be realists. People claim that Obama is a realist. So we would all have to be academics when it came to foreign policy to fully understanding that. But the point is that our new foreign policy is going to come from people who have studied this and who understand what we need to do. And anybody who's elected president is going to have to draw on those sources. And so why wouldn't we as voters want to learn more about what's actually going on and how what kind of strategy we're going to need to employ to deal with it? If you listen to this podcast and you take issue with everything I say, you're not going to grow. I mean, this isn't a debate. This is just my sort of reciting what I know, what I've learned. And you should go and learn more on your own and try to figure out what it is. I don't want to make the same mistake that I made before when I was angry and just wanted something done, which I think a lot of people when it comes to France are. If they attack us in the United States, it's going to have the same reaction as 9/11, where you're going to have a bunch of people who are angry. And, anger is never a place to make decisions from. And everybody was collectively so angry that they didn't want to listen to anybody that said, wait a second, is this what you really want, invading Iraq? And everybody was like, yeah, we're except for a few. Who said maybe we shouldn't do that? We went ahead and did it, and we got predictable results. Do you want to make that same mistake again? I don't. I think we need a new foreign policy. When I say new foreign policy, it's a real question about where is this country going? What's the plan? What's the direction for people in this country? Collectively, in terms of economics, in terms of our future, in terms of what we're trying to accomplish in the world, in terms of what we're trying to accomplish for our people, and how that relates to the rest of the world, and how we would build a new foreign policy to protect our interests, protect our allies, and also to protect our vision of the future. I mean, there's a lot of pieces to it. How do we handle the borders? How do we handle threats like, Al-Qaeda or ISIS? How do we handle relations with Russia and the rest of the world? How do we handle Europe? How do we handle the economy? There's a lot of these issues. None of this stuff is getting addressed. It's getting addressed very rhetorically because people are all really angry about stuff and they want people to say things like it's Wall Street's fault, or it's we need to attack ISIS because we're at war with Islam and we have to do this. Look out for China. We shouldn't allow allow this, and we and these kinds of rhetorical statements that aren't accomplishing anything, and we're just going to get right back into the same bag that we were in before. And this is what I mean by leadership. You know, aren't statesmen supposed to lead the country? Aren't they supposed to figure out the right solution and, you know, lead people to the right solution? Instead, we have these, we have the mob leading the so-called statesmen, and that is not a good recipe for the future. So I'm going to leave it at this because I'm, you know, the fire's starting to go down, and this is where I start babbling. But this is not argumentative. These statements are not meant to be argumentative. They're meant to get people to think and to start doing their own research and come up with their own conclusions. And I'm telling you, what you're hearing on the campaign trail, what you're seeing on Fox News and CNN and MSNBC, what you're hearing on talk radio, it's not approaching what, even approaching a scintilla of what we're going to have to grapple with in terms of the next 25 to 30 years in U.S. foreign policy. Why don't we take a moment and think about it as a people and try to figure out the best thing to do and to work together to come up with a great foreign policy that really does make America safe and that solves some of these problems. Once again, thanks to prideofhomes.com, a husband and wife licensed real estate agent team and real estate investors with expertise to share with you. I talked about the market and the houses that have been sitting empty and how you need to have people who really understand the market to, you know, negotiate the risk in the North and Northwest Metro in Minneapolis and St. Paul. For real real estate expertise, Eric and Aaron Lucero with Luke Team Real Estate, check them out at prideofhomes.com or call 763-433-9100. That's 763-433-9100. And thanks, guys, for sponsoring the Bob Davis podcast. And I again had a great practice today with yoga because of Hydrus. Even when I'm sick, I can still practice and the recovery is there and it's great. You know, again, if you have kids that are in athletics, if you are athletic at all, if you do anything like SoulCycle or CrossFit or workout with weights, Hydrus can make a huge difference in your workout and it really can give you an edge. Check out the banner at the top of the BobDavisPodcast.com. That's HydrusPerformance.com. That explains how to use it, explains what it is, and then shows you how to get some if you want. Increased work capacity, no bloating. It reduces fatigue and cramping, improves recovery. It uses no sugar and there's no calories, and it's been tested with world-class athletes. Hydrus. And thanks you guys for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. And thanks to you for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn. And soon, well, first of all, Blog Talk Radio has to be added to that list, as well as GCNLive.com. I'm doing a new show. It's going to be syndicated to radio stations. It's a one-hour show that's kind of a recap of the podcast, and I'd like you to check it out at GCNLive.com. It should be up there pretty soon. That's kind of a new development. I'm really, really, really excited about it. I'll tell you more about it going forward. But thanks for liking, sharing, favoriting, and following on Facebook and Twitter, and thanks for your donations at the BobDavisPodcast.com. Still getting ready to head out in February for coverage of the Iowa caucuses and then down to South Carolina, which people are actually starting to write about and talk about how it's going to be really a key state because it's the third, basically, I think it's the third primary. So South Carolina comes after New Hampshire and Iowa and then Super Tuesday, and I'm heading on down through the Mid-South, a lot of Super Tuesday states in the Mid-South and out and then down to Florida. And the thing about it is, why do I do this? I do it because I've learned that going out and actually covering these events, talking to people, it tells me a lot more about what's going on than we're going to learn from the media, and then I can transmit that to you. So your donations are helping me do that through the BobDavisPodcast.com. You just look for mobile podcast command. It's the red ambulance there on the page. Click on that, takes you to PayPal, and you can make a donation. And thanks you guys for listening and sharing and liking and all that good stuff to the Bob Davis Podcast. This is podcast 438. I didn't make it true that I'm playing by the rules. I come apart, baby, but now I'm fine. I'm checking troubles, sugar, moving down the line.